Trumpington Street is sculptural in the sunshine, slashes and rhomboids of light and stark shade. Traffic is heavy, and the taxi travels slowly, the driver giving me the tour. We've already had the backs, the mathematical bridge, designed by Isaac Newton, and made, the taxi driver says, without a single nut or bolt. I know this isn't true. Newton died a quarter of a century before the bridge was built, and it does have bolts. Iron spikes driven in at angles obscured from sight. I walked over this bridge almost every day for the best, or worst, part of 3 years. But somehow the moment to say this passed, and so I smile and nod and let my mind drift. I'm writing a story about Caroline Norton, who changed the lot of mothers forever with her battle to reform child custody law, also the blurb on her biography says. I have the biography in a tote bag, though that's as much as I've read of it so far, along with a sheaf of her poems, newly joined now by a raft of photocopies about marriage and Victorian law and women's quest for equality. I've just come from Girton College, the first women's college in Cambridge. Dusty sunlight in high-ceilinged, book-lined rooms, parquet-floored corridors and a lunch buffet, polite tones in respectable surroundings. It all sounds eminently reasonable. Caroline Norton's letters to the Right Honourables, her pamphlets, her famous essay condemning child labour, her bills presented to the House of Lords. I'll read the texts, write the piece. The ghost of my former self, indulged all this June day long, weaving on a rusty bike to and from the university library with a backpack of books, is lost to a sudden battery of car horns from behind and an outburst from the driver. We're here. My husband and children are waiting for me in the Botanic Gardens. I pay him and sling the tote over my shoulder and go, all else forgotten. The following day, I find a lump in my breast. It's not unduly concerning at first. I'm breastfeeding. It's probably nothing. It will probably go. A week passes, then another. It is larger now and definitely there. I phone the GP surgery, who, uncharacteristically, say they can see me tomorrow. Name a time. Okay, great, I say, not sure if I feel reassured or more worried. The next morning, dodging the breakfast scramble, I grab the untouched tote. The surgery is busy and always running late. In the waiting room, I take out the biography. Cut off from her children after an acrimonious split, she went about changing the law for wives and mothers. Right, I say to the portrait on the cover, a languorous oil painting in an off-the-shoulder dress, gold and ruby bracelets and elaborate lacquered hair, delicately holding a quill. Here we go. I skim through Caroline's parents and her early years until, as she puts it, she accepts a proposal of marriage so that her life can begin. There's a whole story in the titles of Caroline's songs, the first things she ever wrote. From before her marriage, Rosalie, my love, awake, the home where my childhood played, never forget me, love. Afterwards, oh, sad, sad is the heart. Why should I sing of days gone by? Love not. The Honourable, or not so, George Chapel Norton mocks her letters and her ambitions, sets her writing things ablaze. He buys himself a cabriolet with her royalties, a fancy and entirely unpractical vehicle. But when the doctor tells her to get some sea air to relieve the nausea of her second pregnancy, she is forced to share a bed with the landlady to save money. He slaps her face. He beats her. He pulverizes her face so badly the sight of it makes her sister physically ill. He orders her from his seat at the breakfast table, and when she refuses, he takes the boiling tea kettle and presses it down on her hand. Then he sits in her place and calmly eats his breakfast. She leaves him. He begs her to take him back. She takes pity on him and, for the sake of their boys, gives him another chance. Within 2 days, he beats her so badly she loses her unborn child. He leaves her bleeding on the floor and goes to shoot grouse in Scotland, refusing to pay the doctor's bill, leaving her to beg her brother for money. For weeks afterwards, she sits looking at raindrops on the window. I begin to think I must have lost my soul. My name is called, but the GP wants a second opinion and asks me to return to the waiting room until her colleague is free. A weeks-old baby wails in pain, and my body responds with a swell and rush of milk. I text my husband instructions on what to feed the baby for lunch. I fish the book from my tote bag again, then hesitate. A moment, what we used to call a goose walking over my grave. This isn't how it was supposed to go, a second opinion. I was expecting, oh, it's just a milk duct, use hot compresses and a comb. It's suddenly not what I want to read about anymore. Mothers, children, loss. I text my husband again. It's all fine here, he texts me back with a row of kisses. Of course it is. He's a brilliant father. We're equal partners. But still. Don't be silly, I tell myself and force my hands to stop trembling and open the book. Her brother tells her to come to his house in Dorset for Easter, with the children, without George. Her husband forbids it. She doesn't know what to do. She decides to wait until he's at work, then sneak away, but he makes his move first. She returns home one morning to find the children and their nanny gone. Frantic, she manages to bribe it out of a footman that they've been taken to a lodging house in Upper Berkeley Street. She rushes to the house and begs the servants there to let her see her children, just for an hour, just for 5 minutes, just to tell them she loves them. But their master's instructions are clear and his threats severe, and they refuse. I could hear their little feet running over my head while I sat, sobbing below, only the ceiling between us, and I, not able to get to them. Her eldest is recovering from scarlet fever. She doesn't trust her husband with their second, whom he taunts and dislikes, and the youngest is still a baby. She is desperate, but there is nothing she can do. The children are George's property, his to do with or dispose of as he sees fit, until they reach their majority at 21. He sends them to his sister in Scotland. He changes the youngest child's name. When the middle child needs to be corrected, he is stripped naked, tied to a bedpost and whipped with a riding crop. She sees them one day in London for a few snatched minutes. They are nervous wrecks. The middle one a perfect skeleton. They do not understand why she has abandoned them. They beg her to stay. Her heart aches with the weight of all that is impossible to explain. The following day, a message from her husband. The boys will not be seeing her again. The years pass. The second GP frowns and says carefully that although it is probably nothing, it is certainly something, and she'll refer me to the breast clinic at St. Bart's. Out in the street, I finish the last few pages of the chapter I'm on. George writes to my Carrie that the boys are so grown up that she would not recognise them if she passed them in the street. He says she can have them back if she engages a female companion of his choice. When she agrees, he immediately backtracks. He says they can join her on holiday. She rents a house by the sea, lights fires, airs the rooms. 10 days after they are supposed to be there, they still have not come. George says she can see them in London instead. She abandons the house and returns to London. He says he changed his mind. You have made, she writes to him, an orphanage of our lives. I text my husband to tell him I'm on my way home. All okay, I ask, with you and the children? All fine, he texts back. Okay with you? And my fingers, fumbling, don't know what to say. They were not like us, the historian at Girton College said. We often think of the Victorians as basically the same as us, a bit stricter, more sentimental maybe, but they were not like us at all. Imagine that almost everything we believe, all that we take for granted, is overturned. That's how far we are from them. That distance, and then some again. They tell you to allow a whole half day for the clinic. There are ultrasounds, mammograms, radiographers, registrars to see. I find a corner seat, then move when I realise it's by a rack of leaflets with titles such as Cancer and Pregnancy and Preparing a Child for Loss. In the various waiting rooms, I pore over Caroline's letters in digitised archives online as she takes her personal loss and transmutes it into something greater than her. Something heroic, enduring, revolutionary. She dreams her husband is dying, attended by two old women who berate her. She dreams an unborn baby has drowned. I saw him float away and no one would attend to me because I was mad. Since they were born, I've dreamed of losing my babies too. I dream that I get off a long-haul flight and my phone starts ringing. My husband, thousands of miles away, asking where on earth I am, and in the background the baby's crying, desperate for me, and it's too late to undo what I've done. I am dying and I'm scared, and they tell me to keep calm and hold the hands that reach down for me, and I do, and feel myself pulled from my body. A moment's relief. Then the agony of realising I will never hold my children again. I beg for one last chance and am let sink back into my body, sore and clumsy, and I take my boy into my lap and hold him tight, the smooth, warm curve of his back, and know that this is all that matters. Ever. 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 Caroline, without her boys, her Penny, her abandoned chicken Bryn, her Tutu the little tadpole, stays awake all night long, night after night, staring into the dark until visions of their large brown eyes swim up, as when I looked up from my work and found them watching. She would be annoyed with them then, for interrupting her, for breaking the spell. She writes, has always written, to survive. Her first novel paid for the birth of her son, the doctor's bills and the nurses. She accedes to her publisher's demand and writes a bijou almanac, designed for the Christmas market, an inch and a half wide and sold with its own miniature eyeglass. She tries her hand at plays. She'll turn her pen to anything. She always has, and has always had to, children or no. She tests out guilt and refuses to feel guilty. Refuses shame, too. There is too much fear of publishing about women, she writes. It is reckoned that they wish nothing better than to hide themselves away and say no more about it. No longer, she writes. She will tell her truth, and she will change the world. When I can't concentrate on Caroline's letters any longer, I read Twitter instead. Swiping, tapping, swiping. In the US, the children of asylum seekers are being taken from their parents at the border. There are photographs on social media of minibuses fitted with rows of baby carriers for transporting infants to tender age shelters. There is shaky handheld footage and anonymous testimony. Children led away from their parents to be bathed, never to come back. Breastfeeding babies pulled from their mother's arms. Sobbing toddlers clinging. A newsreader breaks down on live TV, unable to read the auto cue. The US president rants on Twitter, self-righteous or affecting outrage. I think of George Norton, suspicious, capricious, belligerent, ploddingly unintelligent, an ungovernable child, foaming and stamping and rambling from one accusation to another, so that it was impossible to make out, wrote a clergyman attempting to mediate, what he wanted. Or whom he meant to attack. Laura Barrera, an attorney at the immigration clinic in Las Vegas, tweeting at Abogada Laura, "My 5-year-old client can't tell me what country she is from. We prepare her case by drawing pictures with crayons of the gang members that would wait outside her school. Sometimes she wants to draw ice cream cones and hearts instead. She is in deportation proceedings alone." 5:55 p.m. June 28th, 2018. I read and read the stories online, unable to look away. A 6-year-old who is blind and her nonverbal 4-year-old brother, nonverbal in part because he is traumatized. An attorney quoted on the BBC, "Even a 5-year-old who wasn't traumatized can't always tell you their address or what their parents look like or their last names. How do you expect a child to do all that?" They do the scans. In a darkened room, they do a biopsy. The results will be back within 7 to 10 days. Back home, I quiz my not-yet 4-year-old son, "What's your full name? What's mine and Daddy's? What's our address?" Half of the time, he gets most of it almost right. July. The UK prepares for the US presidential visit. On the morning of July 13th, I watch over livestream as protesters launch the huge inflatable baby with its snarling lopsided mouth to float above the Palace of Westminster. My son and I have made our placards, sellotaping pieces of A4 card to sticks of bamboo, and we intend to join the protest march. But at the last minute, the stupefying heat of the day, the thought of the sweltering tube, I chicken out. My son is relieved, worried that the man who steals children will try to take him. "I will do this," he says, and bares his teeth in a chimp-like snarl. Then he buries himself in my side. "I want to stay with you for all the days and all the nights." "Yes," I say. "Yes." Later, I look at the best placards on Twitter. Mary Poppins carrying her iconic umbrella beside a slogan in rainbow colours, "Super callous, fragile, racist, fascist, Nazi, POTUS." Ours simply said, "Breastfeeding babies belong with their mamas." Caroline to Lord Melbourne. "I wish I had never had children. Pain and agony for the first moments of their life, dread and anxiety for their uncertain future. And now, all to be a blank." In the evenings after he's gone to bed, I arrange my son's collection of dinosaurs to look like they're building a tower with his sister's bricks. I think of the fairies who lived in my doll's house and occasionally left letters, tiny writing in cards no bigger than postage stamps and packets of Parma violets. But my sisters and I were older then. He will barely remember any of this. "Do you remember before your sister was born?" I ask him, and he thinks about it and says no. He thinks some more and says, "I hurt my knee in Croatia," which is true, he did. A bad graze falling off a low wall, and the shock of the blood made him howl for an hour. In good moments, Caroline is convinced that there is still hope. "Let them do all they can about the children," she writes. "I will undo in 2 hours what they have laboured to do for 10 years. I have a power beyond brute force to swing them round again, back to their old moorings." But mostly she feels the lethargy of despair. No future can ever wipe out the past, nor renew it. The children won't recognise her if she passes them in the street, nor she them. The youngest is no longer the fair, fat baby he used to be. Those months, those years, those precious days are lost forever. It is unbearable. The thought that a child will not remember its mother. There is a psychoanalyst who says that at a certain moment in pregnancy, if the mother-to-be is pregnant with a baby girl, 5 generations fuse together. It comes at around 20 weeks gestation, when the unborn child, in her tiny seedling ovaries, makes the hundreds of tiny eggs which will be her future children, or the possibility of them. In that moment, the not-yet child is already mother. The not-yet mother, already grandmother. Just as the mother-to-be was once a possibility inside her own in utero mother, carried by her one-day grandmother. I like the Escher staircase of it, the sense of nestled Russian dolls. The potential grandchildren that I might never even see, joined in a vertiginous rush with a grandmother who only barely met me, the centuries collapsing. But the psychoanalyst uses the image to explain how suffering is passed down the generations, how we become trapped in the behaviours of our parents and theirs, doomed to repeat destructive patterns unless we find ways of breaking free. The iniquities, as the Bible solemnly tolls, visited unto the third and the fourth generations. The loss of a mother may be played out in the souls of your children's grandchildren. The lawyers at RAICES, Texas's largest immigration legal service, estimate that at least a quarter of the children, a number in the hundreds, will never, ever be reunited with their parents again. I bought the psychoanalyst's book because someone quoted him on Twitter, saying that the US president was doing exactly the job he needed to, forcing into consciousness some of our collective unconscious issues. He told us not to look at him, but to look to ourselves. I didn't quite know what I made of this. The notion that we get the people we deserve or require seemed to let an individual off the hook, or conversely, to imply that their achievement wasn't that great. I think of Caroline and Abogada Laura. At night, the children tumble through my dreams. I wake in a tangled sweat. I can't even go to a march. In her cot beside me, the baby whimpers. I sit for hours, years, until my breathing calms. She changes the law single-handedly, but it's too late for her. The elder boys at 10 and 8 are beyond the law's reach. The youngest, so long as his father keeps him in Scotland, is beyond its jurisdiction too. Little William Norton dies of lockjaw, tetanus, one Monday in September, aged just 9, after falling from his horse and cutting his arm. The boys are alone and unsupervised at their uncle's house. Willie makes his way to the nearest neighbour, where he collapses and is put to bed. By the time Caroline's told that he's unwell, he has already died. She learns that he was conscious when he died and begged for her again and again. I am tired. I try to make my mind let go this moment and this, here, now, my baby's silky hair and milky smell. Ah, duh, she says when she wakes in the night and wants milk. Online, a mother was alerted to breast cancer when her six-month-old started refusing to nurse from one side. It is the night before the biopsy results. I have finished the biography and the letters, and now I read the poems until I know sections of them by heart. If dews could tell how many tears have mixed with the bright gem-like drops that nature weeps, if night could say how many eyes are fixed on her dark shadows while creation sleeps. The day slides into dawn. The hospital again. My name is called. Everything you take for granted may yet be overturned. And suddenly it's over. There is a name for it, and it's not exactly common, but it's benign. You can go, they say. I will make my life matter, I promise, to the day. I will use my voice, I will fight for what is right, The promises well up in me. I will spend less time on social media. I will not take my husband for granted. I will never snap at my children again. My children. I will teach them that it's their job, too, to make a difference. I will try to be a good example. I will. I will. Back in 1863, Caroline finishes a novel in which her heroine refuses to bow to shame. Beatrice Brooke is seduced and then abandoned by the rich, predatory Montague Traherne. Alone in Wales, her illegitimate baby boy dies. But Beatrice rebuilds her life. She sells her drawings and handmade lace. She moves back to London, becomes an artist's model. Against all odds and social conventions, Lost and Saved has a happy ending. Beatrice marries and has another child. This time, the reviews are split. Some call it a work of true genius, her best to date, but others are offended that a fallen woman could be so redeemed. Caroline defends her heroine in the letters pages of the Times, then starts work on her next and final novel, although, of course, she does not yet know it will be her last. Her middle son, in a dreadful echo of my youth, becomes increasingly violent, his wild and capricious moods taking dark turns. He flies into irrational rages and blames her for things that are not her fault, so that she is afraid to see him and hides in her room. He shoves her about and tells her to get out of his sight. He berates her in foul language. He hits her, and he hits his wife. We go on. We endure and go on. The old battles, the same battles, once again and in endlessly new configurations. On the 24th of July, it is announced that the inflatable baby will travel to Sydney for the forthcoming US presidential visit there. On the 25th of July, Raisis tweets a plea to its followers to keep this in mind. Children are still in cages. Parents still don't know where their children are. Some were coerced illegally into leaving the country. The media isn't writing as many stories, but the problem has not gone away. Please, don't let up.